Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. In moments, we'll hear from Jason Wilson, who covers the far right on that foreign nation's dwindling numbers. And at the bottom of the hour, Tim Schrock talks about the Winter Olympics and relations between the two Koreas and the U.S. Before getting to the interviews, I want to say a few words about Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum. Though some unions and labor-friendly analysts have applauded these duties, they have great potential to do more harm than good. Employment in basic metals has been declining for decades, in part because of imports, but also because of automation. For example, steel production, by the Federal Reserve's measure, is up 18% since 1990, but employment in the sector is down 54%. Tariffs will not reverse those forces. And raising the price of steel will hurt steel-consuming industries. An analysis by economists at the Council on Foreign Relations shows that higher car prices as a result of more expensive steel will depress demand enough to kill more jobs in auto than the tariffs could save in steel. Yes, this is a solidly bourgeois source, but their analysis makes sense. It's striking how backward-looking Trump's worldview is. Instead of thinking about the industries of tomorrow, like clean energy, he wants to recreate the world of 1958, dominated by basic industries like steel. Something should be done for the workers and communities who have been damaged by the disappearance of jobs and manufacturing, but this isn't the way to go about it. And now to the far right. Since the riot in Charlottesville, Virginia, last August, the salience of neo-Nazis has declined considerably. They haven't been able to mount a sizable event since then, and at their smaller events, the fascists are typically outnumbered by counter-protesters. Just the other day, the nattily-dressed white supremacist Richard Spencer gave a talk in Michigan State, and it looked like his audience was in the single digits. What's been going on? To find out, I called Jason Wilson, who's been covering the far right for The Guardian. Jason Wilson. What's happened to the far right since Charlottesville? They've kind of fallen out of the news, not completely, but they're certainly not as prominent as they were in the run-up to Charlottesville.
The far right, as we know from our previous conversations, is a slightly slippery term. I suppose the openly Nazified, openly white supremacist parts of the far right have really been, I think, in retreat since Charlottesville. They've never managed to mount another event like that. And their events have been getting smaller, less well attended, and more successfully disrupted by their opposition.
I noticed that poor Richard Spencer had an audience of about five people at Michigan State the other day.
Right. And as we speak, actually, today's Tuesday, Tuesday morning Pacific time, early Tuesday afternoon, your time, you know, we're seeing Richard Spencer actually being chased around the streets. You know, the Michigan town where he tried to have his rally at Michigan State University, I think it was. And, you know, ordinary people are coming up to him in the street saying, get the hell out of our town. So his prominence is really now working against him. And yeah, yesterday's event, Monday's event, was an abject failure. Hardly anyone showed up. He did his usual routine to almost no audience. And the group of counter-protesters was far larger. There were some arrests among that group, but again, we saw a victory for anti-fascist organizers who managed to successfully disrupt that event. And that's really been the story since Charlottesville.
Well, were there a bunch of, you know, people who are kind of fascism curious who were then repelled by the spectacle of Charlottesville?
I think so, yeah. I mean, that day culminated in a murder, and not everyone has the stomach for that. But also, there were arrests. You know, the alleged murderer was arrested. Leaders of the group were arrested, people like Christopher Cantwell. He's been in legal trouble ever since. He's still got an outstanding charge for discharging gas in a public place. Jason Kessler, the other organizer who was actually from Charlottesville, he's been in and out of court ever since as well. He's got a pending trial and a felony perjury charge. And, you know, it seems that he's finding it more and more difficult to live in that town. So there's been a lot of legal stuff that's happened to them. They've had a lot of stuff happen to them online as well. There's a fantastic website called Unicorn Riot, who are openly kind of anarchist, anti-fascist publication, but they've managed to you know, hack or obtain anyway, and release a whole lot of server logs from various far right groups, and other more mainstream publications have done reporting based on their leaks. But they released the whole server logs of the chats that people had in the lead up to and after the Charlottesville event. And that's led, that and other stuff that's happened on social media has led to people being doxxed and identified. And, you know, to their tactics being exposed. And a lot of that stuff now will feed into the criminal trials that are ongoing and coming up. So in a variety of ways, they've really been disrupted. The costs of being a kind of open white supremacist Nazi activist have increased. And what we're seeing and hearing even from them is that their numbers have decreased and, you know, a lot of the groups that were in the so-called Nationalist Front that organized Charlottesville are themselves saying that their numbers have peaked and you know, their numbers really peaked at Charlottesville and have been declining since.
Well, it's quite a change from those days after the Trump election when Spencer had his convention and they're all shouting Heil Trump. Was it, are they ruined by success or what?
Well, you know, we at least have to entertain the possibility that determined anti-fascist activism works, has worked.
Yeah, that was my next question, because, you know, a lot of people on the left, liberals and people further to the left even, denounce anti-fascist activity as either a waste of time or counterproductive. The fascist threat was nothing to worry about. Punching Nazis was immoral and undesirable. But about a year later, we can say maybe the anti-fascists were right.
Yeah, on the terms that they set for themselves, I think they absolutely were. In the events I've attended, you know, over the past couple of years, really, I've seen the consistent presence of counter-protesters, anti-fascist counter-protesters. You know, as I said, a lot of reporting, I suppose you would say, and investigative work by anti-fascist journalists publishing their material online. And, you know, those legal efforts as well have gone on. And the proof's in the pudding, I think. Those groups now are struggling to maintain themselves. And, you know, Spencer himself has been blamed by people inside his movement for what they see as a tactical and optical disaster in Charlottesville. He's not necessarily a popular figure within his own movement now. And, you know, other groups like the Traditionalist Workers Party, there was a great Yahoo News story by a journalist called Caitlin Dixon last month. And she, you know, as far as she's concerned, there's an open question as to whether Matthew Heimbach, who's the leader of the Traditionalist Workers Party, has an organization at all anymore. Just yesterday, Unicorn Riot obtained some more Discord logs from a group called the Patriot Front. That's the new name, effectively, for Vanguard America, who are the group that the alleged murderer in Charlottesville belonged to. And, you know, you've got them inside their own servers saying, yeah, you know, we probably had 250 people at around the time of Charlottesville. And now they're talking about, you know, numbers that are in the low dozens. So, yeah, the proof's in the pudding, really. It's a divided movement. It's been under constant pressure, and it has not withstood that pressure very well. But, you know, that's the openly, I suppose, I keep using that word, Nazified, but the groups who are openly white supremacist, openly, you know, espouse National Socialist or fascist ideology, the kind of people who are marching in Charlottesville, they're really on the back foot. And, you know, the people who've opposed them can take credit for that, I think.
Does this suggest that maybe the threat was inflated from the outset? Or I'm not saying that we shouldn't have fought them, because you want to keep them small. Even if they were small, you want to keep them that way. But were we perhaps overestimating their size and appeal? Or did the fight back against them really have a good productive effect?
Well, I think the fight back against them, you know, has been a grassroots effort that's probably politicized and radicalized a lot of people. So, you know, depending on your politics, if your politics are left, you might think that's a good thing, because, you know, it's introduced, I think, a lot of people into political activism and had them show up week in, week out, month in, month out to these events. As to overestimating their danger, I mean, I think it depends what we consider their danger to be. The numbers for groups who are prepared to go out in the street and go toe-to-toe with the left, you know, in violence, are always going to be pretty low under relatively normal liberal democratic conditions, if that's what we have now.
That's a long...
Yeah.
That could be a long debate in itself.
Sure.
But yes.
But, you know, where there's a kind of institutional integrity still, those numbers are always going to be pretty low. But, I mean... You and I both know the work of people like Chip Bollet, a book he wrote with Matthew Lyons about right-wing populism in America some years ago makes the point very well, I think, that the danger in these groups is that they pull the whole system and spectrum right, whether that's by opening up a kind of space to the right of Republican politics or, you know, whatever, normal conservative politics where racism and white nationalism become more acceptable, and I think we've seen that happen. I think we've seen more frank talk about race from nominal Republicans and conservatives in the last little while than we had before, and an end to the kind of dog whistle politics that they might have preferred earlier, and more open appeals, I suppose, to racial thinking and racial politics.
Yeah, it's like they've replaced the dog whistle with a megaphone. They're not subtle about it anymore.
Right. You know, when the late Roger Ailes was in charge of Fox News, even on at that time, even on Fox News, there were certain things you couldn't say. And, you know, a lot of the appeals to racial politics, which were certainly there, would be coded in various ways. And they'd even try this kind of quasi-colorblind rhetoric where they would claim that what they were saying it wasn't about race. You know, it was just about welfare reform or... you know, terrorism or you know, whatever, pick your topic. Now I think you've got someone like Tucker Carlson in prime time, and he, in the last year, has run segments about the menace of Roma people, you know, or gypsies, as he called them, in America, bringing new and exotic flavors of racism to the table, you know, on Fox News. He's had people on his program who have either... you know, retailed, you know, conspiracy theories about the Las Vegas shooting, you know, that it was done by Al-Qaeda or ISIS, or who have themselves made pretty stark appeals to white racism. If they've had a success, it hasn't been in kind of street organizing, which is always something that they want to do, but in perhaps, you know, mainstreaming or normalizing certain ways of talking about race and mainstreaming or normalizing certain ways of thinking about the issues that they care about.
I'm speaking with the journalist Jason Wilson. You live in the Northwest, which has been long been a hotbed of white supremacy, going back to when Oregon was created as a whites-only jurisdiction. Do you feel any different there? I mean, is the local scene different?
I think that probably the street organizing has hung on for a little longer here for the same reasons that Oregon and the Pacific Northwest are always attractive to white supremacists. And that is mostly that the white majority is so large and that communities of color are relatively small. And that means simply that they feel safer in staging street protests and staging these kinds of events. So, the group Patriot Prayer, which is led by a guy called Joey Gibson, who's now announced he's running for the U.S. Senate in Washington, by the way. That group has continued to stage events. They've been getting a little smaller on the whole, but they've attracted a whole new bunch of younger men associated with the Proud Boys, who are a group started by Gavin McInnes, the founder of Vice, who, again, claim not to be white supremacist or fascist, and kind of mask their politics in various ways and present themselves as a kind of fraternity type group. But they've been showing up to Joey's events, and Joey's continued to have events. You know, he's been defending abortion clinic protesters in Olympia, Washington. He had an event that terminated in street fighting up in Seattle last month. He and on the weekends in Salem, Oregon, I was at an event which was the March for Trump, March for Trump, numeral four, which was held on the anniversary of Marches for Trump last year, and that also terminated in some street fighting and a number of arrests of counter protesters in sleepy Salem. So, I think in the Northwest, the street action has, as I said, kept kept going to some extent, because in part because of demographic kind of factors here. But also I think, I mean, I don't know if you want to get into this, but I think that the Republican Party itself is quite radical, more radical than you might think in the Pacific Northwest, and you know, he receives certain kinds of encouragement and permission from them as well, I think.
Well, then there's also the Bundys and the land protests and all that. How do these all fit together?
Well, I mean, they're all underpinned by a kind of, you know, aggrieved white entitlement, I guess. That's one thing. There are people who make a kind of analytical distinction, which I think is useful, between, you know, open white supremacist groups who are more concerned with race and, you know, creating a white homeland like Spencer is, and, you know, ethno-nationalism. People make a distinction between that and the patriot movement, which the Bundys might be more associated with, which is about, you know, a kind of anti-government movement, which is about maintaining a particular reading of the Constitution that where they think that, you know, local authority should be, or the sheriff should be the highest constitutional authority in the land, and the federal government has overreached itself, and, you know, it's all essentially about land use and wanting to turn back public lands over to economic exploitation of various kinds. People make a distinction between those two movements, but, you know, you look at rallies in the Pacific Northwest, and, you know, all of this stuff kind of gets smooshed together. And there are, you know, we know this on the left as well. There are people who are opportunistic about attaching themselves to movements or events where they think they can derive a political advantage out of it and achieve their political goals. But I also think that radical movements tend to be quite small and people get mixed up in them. So you'll see at Joey's events in the past year, we've seen white supremacists, people from Identity Europa, shoulder to shoulder with people with 3% logos, you know, and last June being protected by Oath Keepers, and, you know, people who are classically you would think of as part of the patriot movement. So it's all kind of smooshed together a little here. I would expect maybe that both of those things will keep simmering away. I think both of those movements, if they look at the big picture, they've kind of had victories in some ways. I mean, Trump's turning back public lands, shrinking the size of public lands in Utah, and if he gets around to it, I imagine he'll try to do that elsewhere. And at the same time, he's continuing to give encouragement to white supremacists who see him as their best kind of political opportunity in some time, you know, with ICE raids and deportations and continuing tough talk on immigration and refugees and what have you.
Well, with Trump in the White House, do some of these far-right groups now lose some of their relevance? They, you know, they've got policy that is looking rather congenial to their agenda, so maybe they don't really need to be so active if they've got Trump and ICE on the march.
It's delicately poised at the moment. The remarkable thing about Donald Trump is that the Patriot Movement, for example, I'm sure you remember there in the 1990s, their last kind of upsurge, which was under the Clinton administration. They started to gather steam again during the Obama years, driven in part by the Tea Party movement. In both of those instances, they were really responding to, you know, liberal presidential administrations, which they felt were inimical to their interests, and they had all kinds of conspiracy theories about. The remarkable thing about Trump in, say, the first year of his first term is that he managed to galvanize right-wing movements, even though, by all appearances, the right was in control of pretty much everything that there was to control. And he did that, I think, and continues to do that to some extent by cultivating this sense that his presidency is embattled by the deep state or by the Mueller investigation.
Well, there's enough truth to this to give it credibility, really.
Right. Well, yeah. He's certainly not comfortable. He was able to kind of galvanize the far right in a way that we've only previously seen when in circumstances where they're not in control. So he's been able to cultivate that quite successfully. And the reason that people are coming out and having marches for Trump and in support of Trump is that they feel like he's their guy to some extent, and that his presidency is under threat, and so psychologically they're kind of in the same place that they would be under, you know, maybe under a Clinton administration. They're feeling like they're under the thumb, and they're able to craft their own political appeals on that basis. So
a lot of the emotional appeal of the far right is this sense that it's a last gasp defense. They're under the forces of history are against them. They're fighting to preserve Western civilization, white civilization, all this. So that they actually thrive in that sense of threat and marginalization.
Yeah, and you know, in each case, there's a kind of conspiratorial view of history as well. So, you know, the folks like Spencer and his ilk talk about, you know, demographic decline and demographic replacement. That's what they were saying at Charlottesville. You will not replace us, you know, which they often see as orchestrated by Jews, you know, a kind of influx of immigrants, non-white immigrants, which is being somehow coordinated by Jews. On the Patriot Movement side, I mean, there's no shortage of anti-Semitism there if you dig as well, but the worry seems to be a kind of depletion of U.S. sovereignty and, you know, a kind of an imposition of either world government or a sort of tyrannical federal government under the control of people who are also against the same kind of people, white Americans, but for different reasons. So, and in between that, there's all kinds of, you know, mixtures of that, but in each case, yeah, there's a kind of feeling of a looming threat, being on the wrong side of history, as you say, a kind of emergency tyranny, which is aiming to squash them personally, and, you know, a conspiratorial basis for all that. And, you know, Trump's pretty much, you know, Trump understands that, I think, and he's an inveterate conspiracy theorist himself. So I think he knows how to appeal to that. And so far he's done that quite successfully. I think unwisely, at least for that little project, you know, the stuff he said about the Second Amendment and maybe doing something on gun laws are the first really significant hit I've seen to enthusiasm about him in those quarters, certainly in the Patriot Movement. That's the one thing that they're feeling betrayed about so far.
And then finally, what about the international dimension? You know, there's certainly a lot of these guys thought of themselves as part of a white international. People have jokingly referred to a Trumpist international. We've seen a lot of gains for the right in Europe. What are the relations of our own homegrown neo-Nazis to these foreign movements?
Well, there's a shared ideology. I think there was a lot of interest from Europe and you know, my home country of Australia and elsewhere when the more Nazified far right looked like it was doing well and there were all kinds of efforts to build bridges there. I think there's still significant links there and they'll still fly back and forth and go to each other's conferences. Oh, and there's a shared sense of being threatened by immigration, and you know, in Europe it's a different kind of worry, which is about Muslim immigration from various parts of the world, but it's the same kind of anxiety about threatened kind of whiteness. And in both instances, I mean, we see in Italy, in Germany, you know, the success of far right parties opens up a space for these guys, and you know, often there are direct links between populist far right parties and you know, street Nazis that are there if you don't dig too deeply. You had Bannon, Steve Bannon, who was the person in the Trump administration with the clearest links to this kind of world, going over to Italy to help out the populist parties in their election efforts. I mean, there are still a lot of links, and there is this kind of project, I suppose, of building this international sense of Euro-American whiteness, which kind of stands alone in the world as a kind of force of decency and civilization. And that's a very powerful idea of theirs, and it's a way for them to build those bridges. The question, I suppose, is whether that can be successfully opposed country by country and what a kind of international, unified international opposition to that on the left would look like. I can only observe that and wonder how it's going to happen. It probably is something that bears thinking about.
That was Jason Wilson, who covers the far right for The Guardian and other publications. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Have you heard on the news about this
Some of We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thing by Heaven 17 from 1981. Next, the Koreas. The recent Winter Olympics held in South Korea became an occasion for big power politics as North and South Korea buddied up in ways that made the United States uncomfortable. The South's president, Moon Jae-in, has been trying to make peace with his northern neighbor while the U.S. government and its servants in the media have been amping up tensions. What does it all mean? Here's Tim Shorrock to explain. Tim grew up in South Korea and has been writing about the country for years. You can find a lot of his work on the Nation magazine's website. This interview was recorded on Monday, March 5th. On Thursday, it was announced that Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will meet in Vancouver at the end of May. This is quite a change from when Trump mocked Kim as Little Rocket Man and the North Korean media characterized Trump as a lunatic, mean old trickster and human reject. Already, bellicose pundits are warning that Trump is walking into a trap by holding this meeting. I asked Tim Shorrock to comment on these developments, and here's his answer. Direct talks between the U.S. and North Korea are the only way this crisis can be solved, and I'm glad that Kim and Trump have agreed on a process to get there. But the real hero is South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Without his diplomacy and commitment to peace, this wouldn't have happened. I feel a sense of relief mixed with elation, and I hope they can pull this off. That's the end of the quote from Tim Shorrock. And now, here's the interview with Tim Shorrock. What did it mean for South Korea going into these Olympics?
When Moon Jae-in, the current president, ran a year ago for president in South Korea in the aftermath of the impeachment of Park Geun-hye, one of his campaign pledges was to restore the, you know, sunshine policy of the past of Kim Dae-jung and other progressive presidents that followed him, basically, you know, using economic incentives and political and social dialogue to make the peace with North Korea and to reduce tensions. He focused on this very much during the campaign. And actually, in an interview with me in The Nation, said this would probably really help the United States and help Trump if there could be peace between North and South Korea. And these Olympics allowed him to do that because on January 1, as we know, Kim Jong-un responded to his many overtures and said they would send a high-level delegation to the Games, to the Winter Games in Pyeongchang. And they did. And, Kim Jong-un sent his sister as well as Kim Jong-nam, who used to be the foreign minister, and he's kind of the highest-ranking government official. But this was the highest-level discussion ever between North and South Korea since 1953, and it was a very, very important breakthrough.
We get such a caricatured impression of North Korea in the United States. How did the North Koreans think of these Olympics? What were they looking forward to?
Well, they were very happy just to participate. They had two athletes that had already passed the test. There were skaters who were eligible to participate, but they sent athletes in other sports. And, the women's hockey team was a mixed team of players from North and South Korea. And this was a huge deal. North and South Korea also marched together into the opening ceremonies and the closing ceremonies. They've done this before. The last time, I believe, was in 2004. But coming at a time of being close to war, this was, very meaningful. A very big deal for people in North and South Korea. And so along with these athletes and cheerleaders and others that went across the border into the South, Kim Jong-un sent, his sister and this high-ranking former foreign minister, and they invited Moon Jae-in to meet with Kim Jong-un at some point in a summit. There hasn't been a summit between North and South since the last progressive president in 2008. It's a huge development, and it was kind of undervalued, I think, here in the United States by both the media and by the government.
And then the Trump administration, how do they view these warming trends between the two Koreas?
I think my most recent article for The Nation was about Vice President Pence and how he his behavior at the opening ceremony when he refused to even acknowledge the North Koreans that were about 2 feet away from him, right? And he refused to meet the former foreign minister, Kim Jong-nam. He refused to even shake his hand at one meeting. I mean, they just pretend that the North Koreans weren't there. And it was basically, you know, looking down on this fact that they're having these people from this regime that they so detest, you know, in South Korea. So they really did everything they could to show that the U.S. did not approve of this kind of contact. Pence, you know, got a lot of bad publicity because of his behavior. And, you know, he told the Washington Post that, you know, the U.S. was willing to talk with Kim Jong-un in some format. And this was like the first time this had actually, you know, come from the White House. So it signaled some kind of change. And then, you know, the other day at this Gridiron Club dinner, Trump made some passing allusions to, you know, sort of said that North Koreans have been in touch with him and he may or may not talk with them. But first they have to, you know, agree to denuclearize, which is kind of a problematic from the beginning.
Yes, agree to everything we demand before we'll start talking.
Exactly. Surrender first and then we'll talk. That's basically been the U.S. position since Obama. It doesn't work, and North Korea has already said they're not going to, you know, go in with conditions. There are people in the administration who've been pushing, you know, against this militarist tide. I would say that the two people are Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Tillerson, who have both been pushing the diplomatic policies and pushing for some kind of negotiation. And Tillerson has at times actually said, you know, we would be happy to meet without any conditions. But the key issue really is that for South Korea, Moon Jae-in government sees negotiations and engagement as a way to bring about a peace process on the Korean Peninsula, where the U.S. would talk to North Korea and take intermediate steps to sort of build confidence and, you know, move to the next stage, with denuclearization being like sort of a final step on this peace process. Where the U.S. position is like they have to denuclearize now. And unless they will agree to talk about denuclearization, there's no point in talking to them.
How much leverage does South Korea have over the U.S. and vice versa?
Far more leverage by the U.S. over South Korea. But Moon Jae-in is, in contrast to the last two very conservative right-wing presidents, you know, has made it a priority not to have a war on the Korean Peninsula, and has been very outspoken about this. You know, we have to avoid a war, you know, by any means. You know, this has to be a peaceful resolution. And that's had some influence because it's difficult for the United States to unilaterally attack North Korea without, you know, South Korea cooperating or collaborating.
Or bursting into flames, too.
Or bursting into flames, right. I mean, you know, Seoul is only 30 kilometers south of the DMZ. So any war would immediately involve South Korea, and then hundreds of thousands of South Koreans could be dead in a few hours if there was a war. So this is a priority. You know, for the Americans, it's like, you know, suddenly the idea under McMaster, who may be on his way out as national security advisor, has been that despite the fact that there was deterrence against North Korea since, you know, the end of the Korean War in 1953, North Korea now with nuclear weapons cannot be deterred. Therefore, we have to end their nuclear program. And it's like they don't see any possibility of North Korea having nuclear weapons as it's for its own defensive needs, which is what they constantly say.
I just read the other day that McMaster has been pressing Mattis to draw up detailed war plans against North Korea, and Mattis has been dragging his feet, which is really annoying McMaster. I mean, that's a pretty terrifying situation where the National Security Advisor is really hot to have the Pentagon draw up actual war plans. Well, I'm sure they've got war plans against everyone, but to draft a new set of war plans, it's really frightening.
It is frightening, and it is frightening when you have a Secretary of Defense being sort of the peacemaker within the administration. That's McMaster for you. And there's others who are waiting in the wings to come in. Like, you know, there's rumors that John Bolton may take over from McMaster as National Security Advisor, and he would be a complete disaster. Last week in the Washington Post, they ran a story where they quoted him from this speech he gave recently talking about not just a one-time kind of so-called bloody nose strike on North Korea, but a massive attack where they would wipe out all their artillery on the border and then go after their nuclear and missile facilities, and a huge kind of military attack. Now, some people are actually talking about that kind of thing. Trump kind of favors that, and he keeps saying things about we're moving towards that if they don't denuclearize. So it is a really dangerous situation. And, I mean, the big question now is whether South Korea and the United States are going to hold their next stage of military exercises, which are nothing small. These are the largest military exercises in the world. And the last couple of years, they've practiced a number of possibilities, including the assassination of Kim Jong-un and his leadership. They call these decapitation strikes. And they practice, you know, nuclear war with North Korea in these military exercises. And, of course, North Korea have used these exercises as dangerous and provocative and would like to see them scaled down or ended. A lot of the discussion right now between South Korea and the United States has to do with these exercises, whether or not, you know, the U.S. can actually agree to putting these exercises off until negotiations, you know, get on to a good footing.
The reaction of American pundits and politicians to North Korea, it's so clear watching them that they don't want countries to develop nuclear weapons because once they have nuclear weapons, the United States can't really mess with them freely.
Right.
And so this actually confirms every paranoid thought, or what we perceive as paranoid thoughts, that the North Koreans have.
Right.
It's the same thing with Iran, too. We don't want Iran to develop a nuclear weapon because we want to be able to push them around if we feel like it.
That's right. You know, even longtime CIA people and people who've been in the intelligence world know that North Korea, you know, really started developing its nuclear weapons and missile systems after they saw what happened with Gaddafi in Libya and before that, you know, Saddam Hussein in Iraq. That nuclear weapons may be one way they can, you know, protect their own sovereignty and protect themselves from a U.S. attack or regime change move. And, you know, they're probably correct about that. And so the United States, you know, doesn't like that. And they want all countries to, you know, to follow, you know, U.S. dictates. And so North Korea stands up to them. None of this is meant to say, you know, North Korea is some kind of great democratic regime or anything like that. You know, they do as a country, as a nation, have a right to exist, although some people would dispute that, and they have a right to continue as a nation and try to exist as a nation and try to improve the situation of their own people. So South Korea is playing a very positive role right now in trying to alleviate and you know, stop a war.
I'm speaking with the journalist Tim Schrock. You talked about this with you on the show about, I think it's about 6 months ago, if Skype is reminding me correctly. We talked about precisely how severe the damage was the U.S. inflicted on North Korea during the Korean War, the early 50s. Just remind us of the extent of the devastation that the U.S. wreaked on North Korea.
Well, in the last 2 years of the war, after the United States moved in and pushed the North Koreans north of the 38th parallel back into North Korea, Truman ordered MacArthur and the U.S. military and their U.N. cohorts to invade North Korea and end the North Korean regime. And during those 2 years, the last 2 years of the war, North Korea was subject to the most massive air attack probably the world has ever seen. I mean, the United States Air Force, which destroyed, you know, dozens of Japanese cities under Curtis LeMay, did the same thing to North Korea, except this time they left no cities unscathed, and everything was destroyed. The number of people killed is 3 or 4 million people, but the U.S. had complete control of the skies, dropped hundreds of thousands of tons of napalm. It was a holocaust. There's no question about that. And North Korea has never forgotten that. Lots of people in the South are very aware of that because, after all, these are their kin. And when they hear Trump talking about we will completely destroy North Korea, they know he's talking about people in their extended families. You know, many people in South Korea have families on the other side of the border. So, you know, this is not ancient history for North Korea at all. And it's also important to note that since at least 1953 and the end of the Korean War, the armistice that brought an end to the fighting of the Korean War, the U.S. has had nuclear weapons pointed at North Korea. And under George H.W. Bush in 1991, the U.S. pulled out its so-called tactical nuclear weapons from South Korea. But they still have nuclear weapons on ships that are, you know, anchored in Japan, the U.S. 7th Fleet, and carried by bombers that, you know, operate out of Guam. So it's still under the nuclear threat from the U.S. And so, you know, North Korea is, you know, has nuclear weapons. They just recently, you know, only since 2006 have they had a nuclear weapon. And so they see this as, you know, bringing themselves somewhat on a par to the United States.
In the U.S., across the political spectrum, there's a consensus that North Korea is a terrible threat and must be contained. And there are certainly degrees, perhaps, of hawkishness, but the fire and fury extends, you know, across both parties, right?
Oh, yeah. Democrats are not much better than Republicans on Korea, although right now you do have some Democrats, leading Democrats in the Senate and the House, pushing for a resolution that would prevent Trump from making a unilateral strike on North Korea. But, you know, generally, you know, as Phil Oakes saying back in the 60s, you know, when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. Love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. I mean, in the last couple of weeks, some of the biggest critics of South Korea's strategy with North Korea and the fact that they're talking in North Korea have come from U.S. liberal publications like the New York Times and Atlantic and New Republic and so on. I mean, North Korea says again and again, its nuclear weapons are designed to aim at the United States if the United States attacks it, not aimed at anybody else. Take away the Korean War, which is questionable whether it actually invaded or not. I mean, it was a war, to them, it was a war of liberation. They never went outside of Korean borders. North Korea has never invaded any other country. North Korea has never invaded a country. You know, how many has the United States invaded?
But we do it with good intentions, you know.
Oh, yeah, we have the best of intentions. Liberals and conservatives who see North Korea as some kind of existential threat basically refuse to deal with the history of what led up to this, that the United States has been an existential threat to North Korea, you know, for, you know, nearly 70 years. And so without that history, there's no understanding of this current crisis. The media makes it out like the United States is an innocent bystander in Korea, you know, when it, number one, still has ground forces in South Korea. A U.S. general heads up the South Korean military during times of war and has, you know, tremendous influence in South Korea. I mean, basically South Korea can't talk to the North without, you know, getting permission from the U.S. And they say that, you know, North Korea can't be deterred. Well, you know, North Korea after the, from 1953 on, there was certainly conflicts and sporadic violence every once in a while. Teams coming down to assassinate Park Chung-hee in the 1960s and other events that have happened, but there hasn't been a war since then. You know, there's been tensions, but no, you know, aggressive approach toward the United States, except these nuclear weapons, of course, are called aggressive. That's the language that American pundits tend to use. When it's, you know, for their part, it's defensive. And the latest justification for U.S. policy is that North Korea wants to use its nuclear weapons and its missiles to basically blackmail, to force South Korea into a forced unification under North Korean rule. And this is, to me, this is so ridiculous. I mean, I've lived in South Korea. I was there last year for a period of months. And, you know, South Korea has a military that's dozens of times larger than North Korea. Its economy is, you know, way, way beyond North Korea. They have a huge arms industry. The idea that somehow South Korea would just roll over at this threat of nuclear weapons and allow itself to be taken over is ridiculous.
The U.S. has a habit of making, well, I guess it's a lot of humans do this, not just Americans, but making cartoons of our enemies. Saddam Hussein was portrayed in a ludicrous light, and, you know, now we're getting a kind of comical, evil genius of Vladimir Putin, but the portrayal of North Korea really seems to take its new levels. This country is presented as a collection of children and lunatics to a degree I don't recall happening to any other countries. What is your understanding of what that's all about?
In some ways, if you read histories of the Korean War, like in Bruce Cumings' great work about the origins of the Korean War, the hatred for Japanese and Asiatics, Oriental people, was immediately transferred to Korea when the Korean War started. So there's a kind of hatred and mistrust of Asians in general, I think, that's been embedded in American history and American military policy. But it's easy to make caricatures. For one thing, there's so little information known about North Korea, and what information there is so exaggerated that it's very hard to determine what's true and what's untrue. I mean, there's so many examples I can give you for the last couple of years where there's been these reports in that the U.S. media have gotten something from right-wing South Korean media or someplace that some general was executed, and then like 2 months later that general will appear next to Kim Jong-un at some military parade, right? So there's a lot of disinformation. And the actual truth of defectors and what the reasons that they leave are obscured by the U.S. media, which latches on, as the Trump administration has, to the defectors. The hope here is that American people will see North Korea they'll revile them so much that they'll go along with a military attack that would totally destroy North Korea, paint them as inhuman, beasts, insane, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's good justification for a war, and it makes it easier to explain how you can get away with, killing hundreds of thousands of people.
Back in the 90s, Bill Clinton negotiated a cessation of North Korea's nuclear program. What was that all about? What did that look like? And could it be a possible model for some negotiations today?
It definitely could be a model, but back in 94, of course, North Korea did not have nuclear weapons. So this was prior to their getting the weapons. They were, they were trying to build a weapons program, and, Clinton decided that that was against U.S. interests and almost launched an attack on them. And then Jimmy Carter went to North Korea and met in Pyongyang with Kim Il-sung, the then leader of North Korea, and hammered out an agreement that became this 1994 agreed framework. And in that agreement, North Korea actually froze its nuclear facilities, its plutonium facilities, for 12 years. That was confirmed by the IAEA when they went back into North Korea after this agreement, came through. And actually, where this is really distorted is that, like, for example, the other night on NBC, they said, yes, they signed this agreement. But then, under Bush sent an envoy there and accused them of having a uranium program, and therefore the North Korea was cheating, and therefore they broke the agreement. Well, actually, Bush came to office with Bolton and these other neocons hoping to undo the Clinton agreement, hoping to undo this agreement under which the U.S. was supplying them with fuel oil and actually light water reactors to replace these Soviet-style reactors that were their road to the bomb. And the U.S., under Clinton, that lasted for quite a while. But then when Bush came in, they wanted to end this agreement by any means, and so they sent this delegation. And they had intelligence that North Korea was actually buying equipment to process uranium, to enrich uranium, but they did not have a uranium program yet. But they told the American side, the Bush administration, that they'd be willing to talk about it and negotiate it, but they denied having it then, and they said, this is up for negotiation. And the U.S. delegation had no flexibility whatsoever to negotiate. They just had to deliver this hardline message, and the program was scrapped. And that was in 2002. By 2006, after that, North Korea threw out the inspectors and began proceeding on this nuclear program again. In 2006, they had built their first bomb under George W. Bush. And interestingly enough, 3 weeks after they exploded that first bomb, Bush approved the first direct negotiations with North Korea in years. Even, Bush was able to negotiate with them to an extent. So I think that these past agreements can serve as a model, but of course the situation now is completely different because they now have almost the capability to launch a nuclear attack. And they have certainly have the missiles to do a lot of damage to U.S. bases in the region.
Are we heading inevitably towards war? Can cooler heads prevail here?
Let's support the diplomacy of South Korean President Moon Jae-in. I mean, he's done an incredible job of, you know, getting these talks going with the North and then at least getting the U.S. to start talking about negotiating with North Korea. And I think that's he deserves a lot of credit for that. And American people should support that and, you know, support Moon and appreciate Moon for getting us out of a catastrophic war.
That was Tim Sharrock, who's been covering South Korea for a couple of decades. As I noted in the introduction to the interview, our conversation was recorded before the announcement of the Trump-Kim summit. Let's hope something comes of it. That's it for me, Doug Henwood, and now it's time for some game theory. Till next week, bye.